This is your Uncle Don here with the 327th edition of my Porcupine Petting Zoo on CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. If you want to tar someone these days, a common accusation is that he or she is a conspiracy theorist. This term has become shorthand for nutcase. It shuts off all rational arguments as effectively as calling one a communist or a Nazi. There are conspiracies out there, and there always have been. In medieval times, leaders of the Christian Church, then holding a monopoly of organized faith in most of Europe, conspired to prevent other religions or lack thereof from encroaching on their lucrative racket. Rockefeller's Standard Oil conspired to eliminate competition 100 years ago. This cartel was exposed and broken up by the U.S. government. A half century ago, there was a conspiracy, proven in court, of producers in the States to fix the price of steel. Manufacturers soliciting prices from various suppliers found them different, but when transportation charges were factored in, the cost per ton miraculously came out the same, down to the very penny. Governments themselves conspire to change public opinion, often to create support for an unpopular war. The battleship Maine was blown up in Havana Harbor, an explosion blamed on Spain. This accusation was later disproven, but by then the U.S. had won a war and effectively annexed the Philippines, Cuba, and Puerto Rico. Hitler's Nazis conspired to burn the Reichstag, blaming it on socialists and setting the stage for a massive purge of opponents. A phony attack was staged on an American Navy ship in the Gulf of Tonkin, cementing support for expanding bombing of Vietnam to the north. This, too, was a conspiracy. Those are examples of overt conspiracies, but there are many more incidents which smack of covert action, or non-action. In 1915, Britain and its allies desperately wanted the United States to join their side in what became known as the Great War. Then, on 7 May, the British ship Lusitania was sunk by a German submarine. This was played up grandly by those opposing American pacifism. A civilian ship carrying innocent passengers was torpedoed by the filthy, nasty Hun. Let's go get 'em. Eventually it worked, and the U.S. joined the greatest slaughter the world had yet seen. Only later was it revealed that this ship was knowingly sent into lethal contested waters, and the Lusitania was carrying, in addition to civilian passengers, war materiel, making it a legitimate target. Might the sending of this ship into dangerous waters have been a passive conspiracy? Let the enemy do your dirty work for you at the expense of a ship and a few hundred innocents. For 46 years, many have postulated a conspiracy behind the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Elaborate scenarios have been concocted, but perhaps there is a much simpler explanation. We know that Lee Harvey Oswald was a loose cannon working at times for and against the U.S. government. Might it have been known to some in power that he planned to kill Kennedy, and this was a fact that was deliberately ignored? Again, conspire to stand aside and let a patsy do the work for you. Was the attack on the World Trade Center a government conspiracy? Few believe that the fanatics commandeering those planes were operatives of the CIA. People advocating this are the ones properly credited with the title of conspiracy theory nutcases. But theirs would have been an overt conspiracy, or one of commission. Debunking this does not discredit the hypothesis that it was known that a plot existed, and it was allowed to progress unhindered. Look to Naomi Klein's shock doctrine for support of this. Dick Cheney and his henchmen in the White House were candid in saying the U.S. needed an equivalent to the shock of Pearl Harbor to galvanize a degree of popular fear necessary to tighten the grip of the security state. It worked in spades. The American public rose in righteous indignation after 9/11, and the Homeland Security apparatus was put in place with undue haste. So who benefited from the imposition of the subsequent war on terror? The military, their contractors, and those of the right wing who believed that individuals had too much freedom and there was a crisis of democracy. That crisis of democracy, of course, was of too much, not too little. I think it's well established that there do indeed exist very real conspiracies, both active and passive. But in the continuum beyond passive conspiracies is a class we might call confluence of interests, guiding actions and lack thereof. The most obvious case of confluence of interest can be seen in the local gas pump. Retailers of gasoline need not meet in secret basement rooms at the local Chamber of Commerce to conspire to eliminate competition. They need only look across the street at prices posted by their competitors. It is follow the leader with no communication necessary. With price competition eliminated, retailers can concentrate on attracting customers with loyalty programs or convenience stores or just plain lazy buying habits. Which brings me to the subject I have been leading up to, fish. My wife and I have returned last week from a camp with BC Naturalists. We met in Lillooet, from which we visited a First Nations band fishing on the Fraser River. They have a seasonal camp where they and their ancestors caught salmon for hundreds of years before invasion by the white man. They're falling on tough times as salmon are becoming smaller and fewer. They truck in drinking water as their traditional river is too polluted from mine wastes. Sockeye salmon returns are down drastically this year. This follows a trend. Is it an accident? Is it the result of a conspiracy or confluence of interest or all of these? Who wins and who loses when wild fish stocks are eliminated? Losers will include native bands whose livelihood depends on salmon. Bears, eagles, and other wildlife which feed on salmon lose, as do forests relying on nutrients carried upstream with the migrants. Commercial fishers of wild salmon face extinction along with their prey. Sports fishers, lodges, and suppliers of their tackle and provisions will lose. Among losers will be naturalists and others enjoying the wild and its creatures. And who stands to win when there are no more wild fish in our oceans, rivers, and streams? Operators of large open-net salmon farms will win big as competition from a better product is eliminated and customers forget how real wild fish tastes. Oil companies will win as opposition dies from those now protesting exploration, drilling, and transport of fossil fuels off our coasts. So-called independent power producers will win as they no longer face battles with conservationists as they dam and foul lifeless waterways. Logging companies win as they need no longer spend time and effort to protect dead streams. As natives are starved off their reserves by lack of fish, their lands will be open to unopposed mining, logging, and residential development. Now let us see how the scales balance political and economic power of winners and losers. On the one side, we have wild animals, rural natives, sport fishermen, independent fishers, nature lovers, and some who live on the spending of outdoor types. On the other, we have fish farm corporations, logging companies, oil corporations, shipping companies, property developers, and private dammers of waterways. All of them see potential riches ahead when our waterways are without fish. I would say power here is somewhat skewed toward the moneyed side. While the average citizen likes his wild salmon, his natural environment, and its wildlife, he has relatively little power to affect decisions relating to their preservation. Here's where the conspiracy theory is tested. Do representatives of industry meet in secret quarters to plot the demise of wild fish stocks? Certainly not. They don't have to. Their confluence of interest leads to a gradual strangulation of wild waterways. Their effects are cumulative, even as Canada's Department of Fisheries and Oceans is mandated, along with its provincial counterpart, to protect our wild fish stocks. These bureaucracies are a small impediment to coming extinctions, as they're starved of funds and manpower while in the hands of inexperienced political appointees with little interest in their purported goals. No, there's no conspiracy to eliminate wild fish stocks, but the evident confluence of interest among players gaining from their demise is overwhelming. Our chances of defeating them are akin to the odds against a salmon trying to leap a new hydro dam. Enjoy your wild Pacific salmon while you can. One day we will have them only in memory. India is now a member of the exclusive club of six nations which have built and launched nuclear boomer submarines. Missiles are not yet installed, but they will be when sea trials for the new ship are completed. This will join those monsters stealthily roaming the seas awaiting the fateful signal to launch their doomsday rockets. This submarine is the first of three for a program India calls their minimum nuclear deterrent. The estimated total cost of them is between 20,000 and 30,000 crore rupees. Crore is a unique Indian word for 10 million, so the program runs upwards of 300 billion rupees. I had to translate those numbers as this information comes from an Indian weekly magazine. A rupee isn't worth much, only a couple of cents, but you can buy a heap of widgets with 300 billion of them. Or you could feed a lot of hungry people. For decades, India has held the honor of being the nation with the largest number of malnourished citizens. Even with their economic growth, India still contains 450 million people living on less than a buck and a quarter a day. India claims that those submarines, the third leg of a nuclear triad of land, air, and sea-based delivery systems, are necessary to maintain a balance with China. This argument is specious. Nuclear weapons are part of their arms race with Pakistan, a race which stresses India's economy but threatens to bankrupt Pakistan. Neither nation can afford the competition, but they're prompted by the United States, Israel, and Russia, which profit from sales of weapons and technology to both sides. It's ironic that these three nations gleefully unload nuclear technology and weapon systems onto both antagonists while preaching the virtues of world nuclear disarmament. If we want to pave the way to a biblical Armageddon, there's no better place to sponsor antagonism than on the India-Pakistan border. Hillary Clinton visited India, creating quite a stir. My Indian source bemoans the fact that her visit did little to cool the arms race between India and Pakistan. According to them, she was interested in promoting American weapon systems while ignoring the danger of nuclear war between the protagonists. She was on a mission pushing U.S. business and cementing the American-Indian relationship as a strategic ally. They already have Pakistan as an ally, but how can one be an ally of two nations perpetually on the brink of war with each other? If the United States and India should stand shoulder to shoulder as allies, the question remains, allies against whom? Where lies this terrible enemy so powerful that the U.S., the nation with half the world's military, cannot deal with it alone? If this enemy is Islam, the choice of India is a dubious one, as that nation harbors over 100 million Muslim citizens. Is the potential enemy terrorism? Even Obama has given up talk of a global war on terror, as his government recognized this is a Bush fabrication. Clinton's State Department is playing a dangerous game in the interests of boosting American trade. Maybe if the U.S. was producing anything of value besides weapon systems, their international commerce would be more supportable. I wondered whether Ignatieff was serious about precipitating an election. Then I saw the defining photograph in the paper. He's off and running for sure. There he was, tie off, shirt unbuttoned, kissing a bloody baby. How trite. And I thought that baby kissing during election campaigns was just a cliche. Harper is sure to trump this. I can taste bile already. Geoengineering is described as a potentially dangerous and unproven branch of climate science that proposes large-scale interference with nature. Proponents of this new field of endeavor suggest that global warming can be ameliorated or reversed through massive intervention in our environment. Among geoengineering's proposals is the development of large numbers of mirrors in space to deflect the sun's rays, or blowing dust into the stratosphere to absorb solar radiation, mimicking the effects of volcanic eruptions, or scattering iron particles on open ocean to encourage the growth of plankton to absorb carbon from the atmosphere. These and other proposals for massive projects to ameliorate human-driven changes have serious flaws. Any one would require nearly impossible funding on an international scale, making implementation unlikely, which is just as well as the danger of unintended consequences is daunting. We can only guess what might happen if those mirrors or dust worked too well. Suppose they precipitated another ice age, or if a mirror became disoriented, focusing a beam at Earth, frying everything in its path. Or meddling with ocean chemistry might disrupt the chain of life in the seas, killing off vital links and ending fisheries. I suspect that this geoengineering is promoted by the same folks who are pushing the idea of clean coal and belittling the idea of Alberta's tar sands being an ongoing disaster. They're using the magician's trick of misdirecting attention from the real problem, human production of greenhouse gases. We will not, in spite of all the propaganda from oil companies and their ilk, save our planet's climate painlessly through massive projects. We change our ways, or our civilization will wilt and die. This is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George, British Columbia. BC Finance Minister Colin Hanson made a remarkable statement in his budget speech. He said, quote, "When people fall on hard times, we provide support for them," close quote. He should have followed through on this declaration by explaining who he meant by we. Certainly he did not refer to the Liberal government of British Columbia. There's little indication of this support beyond the barest of subsistence from the shreds of our miserable welfare system. British Columbia boasts the lowest minimum wages in Canada, along with the highest cost of living. Surely anyone trying to survive with a family on a piddling $320 a week if lucky enough to be working full-time, needs support. $320 is not a wage, it's the rent on a basement room. BC has the highest rate of child poverty in Canada. What the hell are we, Mississippi North? Colin Hanson fits in nicely with the BC Liberal Party politicians. He's a liar. On 23rd of September, there will be a grand display of Canadian Forces prowess on the courtyard of the Canadian Embassy in Washington, District of Columbia, USA. A reproduction of an Afghan village was to be constructed by a subsidiary of Lockheed Martin to be subject to two scheduled demolitions of mock improvised explosive devices, that's landmines to the uninitiated, followed by dramatic rescues by our heroic soldiers. Right there in the American heartland, on Pennsylvania Avenue, midway between the White House and the Capitol, was to be the scene for this performance, but it was not to be. The purpose of this attack and rescue scenario was for the edification and entertainment of generals and hotshots attending a two-day conference, as well as local citizens, to make them more aware of Canada's role as a pawn in Bush's legacy war against Afghanistan. First, the fireworks were vetoed, since Americans are somewhat skittish about explosions in their cities and have been since certain events on the 11th of September 2001. Americans don't need a Canadian-inspired panic in their capital. It was suggested that a chorus of Canadian soldiers chanting boom would be in order, but that was considered too foolish. The entire performance has been quietly canceled for reasons unknown, but the meeting of big shots will proceed, without theatrics. I suppose generals in attendance will agree that more time, money, and soldiers are needed to pacify Afghanistan. Taken to its logical conclusion, each living Afghan will be assigned his or her own NATO soldier to follow them around and keep them peaceful. Who says that Canadian law has no teeth? Our Minister of Defense was busted for violating the Conflict of Interest Act, forbidding cabinet ministers from serving as directors or officers of a corporation. He was on the board of two companies owned by his father, Beaver Lumber and Lorne Resources, positions from which he has since resigned. Canadian Ethics Commissioner sent Peter McKay a stern letter, which I am sure will go on McKay's personnel file. The punishment? A $200 fine. That'll teach the miscreant. Would Peter's conviction make him ineligible for enlistment in the Canadian Forces? I hope not. He recently underwent 2 days of recruit training at Petawawa Boot Camp as part of a CBC television show, Make the Politician Work. He said, "It made me want to sign up." I wish he'd follow through on that. It would do this devious bugger good to spend a couple of years scrubbing toilets, toadying to imperious officers, and perhaps digging for IEDs in his imperial Afghan war. There's good and bad news on the air travel front. The good news is that we no longer have to remove our shoes for airport paranoids, unless, of course, we're headed for the USA. Shoe bombing is out of fashion, so don't let the fuse hang out. The bad news is that flying has new hazards. While we are frisked for lethal nail clippers, potential incendiary bombs are waved through security. These are in laptop computers and other electronic devices. They're lithium-ion batteries susceptible to thermal runaway. While we're safely confined in our tiny seats above, the hold contains devices which could turn our aluminum tube into a flaming skyrocket. Something to think about while you memorize the route to the nearest exit. Republican pressure forced the resignation of Van Jones, White House environmental advisor, because of an offhand comment in an old video wherein Jones called Republicans assholes. This was a clear case of shooting the messenger, as they could not dispute the claim, considering the battles Republicans are currently waging against the manifest interests of the American people. What single word can better describe those defending the medical non-system that kills and maims so many of their citizens? What more succinct way to characterize George Wanker Bush? While Jones lost his job over his characterization of his opponents, they were perfectly free to call him a Marxist and a Leninist. Their outlandish charges lend weight to his claim that Republicans, or at least some of the more vocal ones, are, indeed, assholes. Britain and Germany are promoting a United Nations conference on Afghanistan. They want to see more burden of the war transferred to Afghan soldiers. This reveals a couple of things to me. Those two nations are trying to shift responsibility for the intractable war from NATO to the UN. And they're attempting to wiggle out of having to wear responsibility for losing the war. NATO's divided on the Afghan war, a division which could be the beginning of the end for an organization which should have died along with its late nemesis, the Warsaw Pact. Under pressure from George Wanker Bush, a man I would label as Van Jones did, NATO was dragged from its focus on the North Atlantic to the continent of Asia, where it has no business. This suggestion that responsibility for waging the war should be shifted to Afghan soldiers runs a close parallel to Nixon's attempt to slip free of responsibility for losing the war against Vietnam through what he called Vietnamization. It worked long enough for Nixon to wash his hands of the affair before the puppet army collapsed. It's clear that the so-called Afghan army will not, nor could it, carry on the war against its own people and warlords without massive NATO, read American, aid, for which will not be forthcoming forever. Watch for the whole mission in Afghanistan to collapse amongst loud recriminations and finger-pointing. Billions of dollars wasted and many thousands of dead, and we'll be back where we started with Afghanistan, a cluster of fiefdoms infested with a few isolated and besieged American bases guarding oil wells and pipelines. Remember that liberal promise that this year would see all-day kindergarten for half of our little ones in that age group? Sorry, folks, this promise has gone to that fat, dead file containing other liberal promises. Maybe next year, eh? Or it may be put off until the next election, when the same old shop-worn pledges are wheeled out for gullible voters. Environmentalists should love this. What could be more responsible than recycling old pledges? Speaking of promises needed fit for recycling, we now have a beauty. While visiting Washington meeting President Obama, Prime Minister Harper casually dropped a pledge to throw $130 million federal dollars into the Northwest Transmission Line project. This is planned to run up Highway 37 to Mesiaden Junction and beyond, connecting the remote northwest of British Columbia to the BC Hydro power grid. The total project is budgeted to cost $404 million, but we know this means more like $1 billion with expected overruns. Originally, some $158 million was to be covered by the now-abandoned Galore Creek mining project. Expect that and the balance of $1 billion to be picked up by the BC government through BC Hydro. This will come from our future power bills. And for whose benefit will this line accrue? For all British Columbians, of course, as foreign corporations rush in to mine our minerals, pollute our air and water, then run off with the profits. Oh, a few locals will be hired, of course, and a token amount of taxes and royalties collected, but nowhere near that $1 billion expense. Oh yes, this transmission line will make possible any number of independent power projects, harnessing our rivers and destroying fish habitat for private profit. These IPPs will then feed power into the grid, for which they will be paid more than this power will then be sold to those miners. It's all of a pattern, milking the public purse for private profit. Harper's pledge of federal aid is calculated to win inheritance from those hoping to get jobs or subsidized electricity. Since this project will not begin immediately, it leaves Harper free to recycle his promise several times over, always dangling the same gift before the dazzled electorate. We have a job opening here at CFUR. It involves several hours of work and research and preparation and a regular half-hour presentation each week. The pay is nil and the work thankless. How can you resist? It looks like Doug Strachan will not be resuming his show, Common Sense, this fall, so a replacement will be needed to balance Uncle Don's outrageous left-wing outpourings. Which of you out there screaming at your radio as I pour forth my rants aimed at your heroes like Harper and Campbell will come to their defense? Who wants to trumpet the virtues of unfettered capitalism, of valiant little Israel, of bankers' bonuses, or ongoing colonial wars and the nuclear arms race in preparation for future wars? Come on out of the woodwork and put your effort where your mouth is. Prince George needs its own mini Rush Limbaugh. Fame and notoriety await you. Come to the CFUR studios at UNBC and make your pitch to our station manager. The U.S. Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation faces a looming deficit from having to reimburse depositors of failed banks. The fund, fed by premiums paid by banks, is paying out more than it takes in. American banks were forgiven those annual premiums between 1996 and 2006, as it was determined that the fund was sufficient to cover any anticipated bank collapses. Now, as the fund dives for zero, and may have to rely on a line of credit with the Treasury Department, which means that more money will have to come from those still willing to buy U.S. government debt. How many more trillions are out there to borrow anyway? Here in Canada, we face an opposite situation. Over the years, the Employment Insurance Fund racked up a surplus of income over payments of some $51 billion. But there is no fund. This surplus was appropriated by the federal government and thrown into general revenue. Although this surplus was ongoing, the feds made no move to grant a holiday in contributions, as did the American FDIC with their banks. Maybe it was because the little guy was being ripped off and not politically powerful banks. But if there were any justice in the system, now that unemployment is rising and business is collapsing, there should be a holiday in contributions, and EI expenditures should rise, tapping those phantom savings and stimulating the economy. Instead, since the surplus was blown, the Conservatives, the same ones pledging not to increase taxes, will raise contribution rates for workers and their employers. They defend this outrage by claiming that the current EI collections are in deficit and raising contributions will balance the books. The government, under Liberals and Conservatives, used money from EI to reduce the fiscal debt while building up a corresponding moral debt to working Canadians. They've reneged on that debt as surely as if they refused to redeem Canadian bonds. They compound the outrage by claiming that raising premiums is not a tax increase. I want a new definition of a tax if it's not taking money from citizens without their consent and using it to fund government. I eagerly wait at Harper's reply to that one. This last weekend, we saw protests across Canada against the FST. These gatherings further entrenched a subtle distortion of our language and popular thinking. This has been no accident. Perhaps you didn't notice that our prominent conservative front group calls itself the Canadian Taxpayers Federation. The title itself is both overt and subtle. It leads us to think of ourselves not as citizens, but as taxpayers. The distinction is anything but trivial. Taxpayers have obligations to the state, obligations which most criticize and seek to minimize. Citizens have inherent rights, rights protected by the state, rights which bind us together within the entity we call Canada. Taxpayers are divided into bits and classes which pit us one against another, rich against poor, individuals against corporations. Taxpayers are atomized. Citizens are united within political boundaries. We have joint values and concerns. Such concerns can turn citizens towards social goals like universal Medicare, education, and infrastructure. It's in an industrial setting, it gives rise to unions. It's in the interest of the current crop that calls itself conservative to keep us divided. As long as we are atomized, we are concerned with our small circle of family, friends, religious, and social groupings. We are arrayed against each other, making us prey to politicians pandering to selfishness. Unfortunately, this playing up of our taxpayer function can overshadow our feelings of citizenship. Try thinking of yourself as a citizen first. Every time you hear or read the word taxpayers, replace that term with citizen and note the difference in tone and meaning. This concludes the 327th Porcupine Petting Zoo on CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. You may now carry on with your life.